Chapter 5 Juan held up a hand when he heard the distinct sound of approaching helicopters. The noise was muted by the jungle canopy, and he couldn't hope to spot them through the dense foliage that hung over the ground like a living shroud. But the best hunters in the world can spot the tiniest movement in the riot of vegetation, and he had no doubt that these were military choppers. They didn't have that refined sound of executive helos built to deliver the pampered. These sounded raw, stripped down to the bare essentials in order to pack in as many men and as much gear as possible. Yet the human eye perceives motion better than pattern, so the men waited, crouched along the game trail until the sound faded, ominously, in the direction they were heading.
"What do you think, Chairman?" Jerry Pulaski asked.
"Our welcoming committee has arrived. Let's make sure they don't have time to set up the party." Juan checked the handheld GPS. "The trail is taking us slightly east of where we need to go. Time to hoof it cross-country. Same formation." By staying low, the men could duck under the thicker leaves and fronds, though Jerry, with his 6-inch height advantage, found himself at a disadvantage in the jungle. After 10 minutes, razor-sharp leaves had cut his face as though he'd been shaving with a month-old razor, and insects dove at him with the abandon of kamikaze pilots in their hunger for such an easy meal. To add insult to already injured bodies, the terrain started to rise. They were heading into foothills of mountains they'd seen on the recon photographs, and the smell of burning brush was growing stronger. The slash-and-burn logging operation was only a few miles away. Juan did the best he could, blazing a trail through the underbrush, and when he spotted what looked to be a large opening ahead, he made the mistake of rushing through rather than checking it out first. He stepped onto a dirt road at the very instant a semi-trailer went roaring past, its engine beat muffled by the bend it had just rounded. Had Juan emerged a second later, the driver would have seen him, though not in time to brake. Cabrillo froze, windmilling his arms to prevent himself from taking a final step under the empty timber hauler's massive tires. The stakes used to contain the logs the big rig hauled down to the river flashed inches from his face, and the vortex that cut through the soggy air threatened to suck him into the hurtling steel. And then it was past in a cloud of dust. Juan took what could have been his last step and exhaled a breath he hadn't realized he'd been holding. Training then bypassed the fear and shock, and he dove flat onto the deeply rutted road on the off chance the driver glanced at his rearview mirror. Cabrillo lay prone until the truck rumbled out of sight, then dodged back under cover.
"Close one," Murph remarked unnecessarily.
Juan knew his subordinate was teasing him, but didn't rise to the bait. When they were sure no more trucks would roar out of nowhere, the team dashed across the road in a tight pack, with Mike Trono trailing a hastily cut branch to obscure their boot prints. Safely hidden on the other side, Juan withdrew the gamma detector from his pack. The piece of electronics was military-grade, meaning it was as simple as the builders could get it. The machine itself was a matte black box about the size of an old tape recorder. There was a simple on-off switch, one red light, and a clear panel that showed a single needle. When the red lamp came on, the machine was detecting gamma rays, and by sweeping it through 360 degrees and watching the needle, the user would learn in which direction the source lay. Juan turned it on. The detector chirped once to tell him it was working, but the indicator light remained dark. They were still too far from the downed power cell to detect the trace amounts of gamma rays it emitted. They started slogging higher into the hills, crossing and recrossing the same haul road as it switchbacked up the mountain. The smell of smoke was no longer an ethereal wisp carried on the breeze. The air was slowly filling with it, and white clouds clung to depressions in the land like noxious gas from a chemical attack. Mark suggested flagging down the next truck they saw to ask for a lift, and was only half joking. Juan knew the men were getting tapped out and decided that once they had the NASA cell in the shielded harness, they would find some place to lay up for the night and make their way down to the boat and the hell out of Argentina the next morning. It was noon when they reached the crest of the mountain. They approached it cautiously, on their bellies, so as not to show movement to anyone in the valley beyond. What greeted them was a scene out of hell. What had once been a lush primeval forest was now a barren wasteland of mud and brush many miles across. Burn piles as tall as haystacks gave off towering pyres of smoke and fire while yellow excavators lumbered across the landscape, whole trees caught in their mechanical jaws. Amid the chaos, like ants, were men moving from grove to grove, their saws keening, then straining, as they bit through timber that had taken generations to grow. Off to the team's left, the clear-cutting was spreading like a cancer up the flanks of a mountain that had already been scarred with yet another recurving haul road. Something caught Juan's attention. He handed the gamma detector to Mark Murphy, grabbed binoculars from his pack, and checked that the angle of the sun wouldn't reflect off the lenses before putting them to his eyes. In the distance, he could see a flattened area halfway up the hill that was used to load logs onto the semis. There was an aluminum-sided construction trailer and several specialized timber industry vehicles, grapple-claw crawlers and log skidders with cleated steel tires. Just beyond sat the two choppers they had heard earlier, their rotors sagging in the afternoon sun, their camouflage paint scheme nearly matching the jungle behind them. Soldiers were assembled in a loose parade formation while two other uniformed men, officers, he assumed, were talking with a small group of loggers. At their feet lay a charred scrap of metal. Juan couldn't make out details, but it didn't take a great intuitive leap to guess it was a fragment of the downed rocket or its payload. As he watched, the civilians repeatedly pointed up the mountainside as if indicating that something important had happened near its summit or just beyond.
"What's going on?" Mike asked.
"The party's getting started," Juan said grimly.
"I got something," Mark said, sweeping the gamma ray detector.
"Where?" Juan demanded.
"Over there,"
Mark pointed.
"Signal's weak, but it's definitely where the Argies are having their little powwow."
Juan imagined the events leading up to this particular tableau. When the rocket exploded and rained debris across the jungle, something landed in the clearing and was recovered by the loggers. They dragged it to the staging area to show the foreman, who called in the military to investigate. At this moment, they were telling the soldiers that another piece of debris had crashed at, or near, the top of the mountain. Major Jorge Espinoza of the 9th Brigade liked orders. He liked receiving them, he liked giving them, and he liked to see when they were carried out. The nature of the orders never bothered him. Told to march through a swamp for 7 days during the training for his coveted maroon beret, or burn a hamlet of indigenous farmers to the ground, it made no difference. He carried out both with utter determination and dedication. In his years of military service, he'd never once questioned if his directives were moral. That played no part in his reasoning. Orders were given. Orders were executed. There was nothing else. His men saw him as the perfect leader, one unfettered by emotion or doubt. But in his private moments, Major Jorge Espinoza admitted to himself that there were orders he preferred over others. He'd enjoyed slaughtering villagers a lot more than spending a week chest deep in a leech-filled swamp. His was a military family that had served Argentina for 4 generations. His father had been a colonel in intelligence during the glory days when the generals ran the country. He had regaled his sons with stories about what they did to enemies of the state, of helicopter flights laden with bound dissidents over the icy South Atlantic. They made a game of heaving them through the open door from 1,000 feet. The object was to throw the second man onto the frothing splash of the first, and so on with the rest of the prisoners. It was the psychopath's version of ring toss, but Jorge never saw it that way. He had been too young to see action when the British retook the Islas Malvinas, but had been trained by combat veterans and had been an exemplary soldier ever since. When the 9th Brigade was formed after General Corazon led the charge against the weak former president, Jorge Espinoza had been one of the first to volunteer. His training was no easier than that of the younger enlisted men he now commanded,
and for that he had forever gained their loyalty. He was now the deputy commander of the entire brigade under General Philippe Espinosa, his father, who had come out of retirement for the position. Any rumors of nepotism were silenced by the sheer ruthlessness and efficiency with which the younger Espinosa carried out his duties. And he was a commander who liked to lead from the front, which was why he was here, deep in the Amazonian region of his country, talking to lumberjacks about something they had seen crash near their worksite. The wreckage they had shown him certainly looked like part of the American rocket. It was made of lightweight aluminum, carefully riveted so not the slightest imperfection showed on its surface. The edges were torn as if by an explosion, and there were score marks on the white paint. The junta saw the recovery of any piece of the rocket as potential to embarrass the United States. They didn't know what the payload had been. NASA claimed a weather satellite, but the generals in charge couldn't ignore the chance that its purpose was espionage. "We think another piece landed on the far side of the mountain," the lumber foreman said, pointing to the half-denuded hill behind them. He was nervous around so many maroon berets, but had felt it his duty to call in the military.
"It is past where you see those men logging on the hill. Some of them wanted to go find it, but I pay them to cut timber, not explore. It was bad enough they wasted an hour digging this one out of the mud."
Espinosa glanced at his aide, Lieutenant Raul Jimenez. Unlike the major, who had light brown hair and blue eyes from his paternal grandmother, Jimenez maintained the gypsy dark looks of his Basque ancestors. The two men had worked and trained together for nearly their entire careers. The difference in rank wasn't because of differing abilities, but because Jimenez refused to leave his friend's side for a command of his own. They needn't exchange a word to know what the other was thinking.
"Round up as many men as you can in 15 minutes, Jimenez commanded. He had a drill instructor's voice that demanded action. "We will form a skirmish line and make our way up the mountain until we find what the Yankees lost in the jungle."
The only sign that the logging company foreman was upset by the order was that he scratched under his filthy hard hat before nodding.
"Anything for the 9th Brigade."
The civilians moved off to roust their men, leaving Espinosa alone with his adjutant. Both men lit cigarillos, sharing a single wind-resistant match.
"What do you think, Jefe?"
Jimenez asked, exhaling a cloud of smoke that mingled with the pall already hanging over the camp.
"We'll find whatever these men saw," Major Espinosa said. "The only question is if it will be worth our while. Any time we can show the world that the Americans aren't infallible is always good for the Ministry of Propaganda."
"World opinion is so against our government right now that I'm afraid a few bits of space junk won't change many hearts or minds.
But orders are orders, yes. And this is a good training exercise for the men. They can grow soft clearing out villages from the comfort of our gunboats."
Cabrillo and his men were already on the move by the time the logging camp's foreman was ordered to gather his men. It would be a race to see who reached the prize first. Juan and the team had more ground to cover, but they would remain near the crest of the hills while the Argentine soldiers were forced to climb the mountainside. They would be further hampered by the need for a slow, deliberate approach to their search. The men from the corporation had the gamma detector acting like a bloodhound to help pinpoint the power cell. Knowing the competition was close goaded them on, allowing them to push past the aches creeping into their muscles and joints. If they could reach the power cell and retreat, then the Argentines would have no idea they were ever here. The men moved swiftly but maintained noise discipline. There was no sound louder than the rasp of vegetation on cloth and the steady whisper of their breathing. The smoke billowing up from below, where the forest was being cleared, was just a thin veil at their altitude, but down where the soldiers were starting their skirmish line, it was one more impediment to their search. Juan didn't break stride when he heard the approaching whine of a helicopter's jet engine, but he couldn't help but feel his heart sink. He should have realized they would use aerial reconnaissance.
A piece of space debris weighing 70 pounds and slamming into the Earth at terminal velocity would leave an impact crater more than large enough to be spotted from the air. It was only a question of whether enough jungle canopy remained to hide it from above. He had a feeling they wouldn't be that lucky.
"Signal from the detector's still looking good," Mark said. They had abandoned a normal separation for the fast trot around the mountain's top, so he was just a few paces behind the chairman. 40 hard minutes later, they were close to where the chopper traversed the jungle, searching for any sign of an impact. There was no way to know how the soldiers on the ground were doing with their ascent. The men were forced to reduce their pace whenever the Argentine Hilo flew within visual range. Juan wished their detector could give them a range to target. Without that information, he didn't know if they were near the power cell or had another mile to go. The noise from the chopper suddenly changed. It no longer dopplered back and forth through the haze, but held a steady rhythm. It was hovering about a half mile ahead. That could mean only one thing. They were over the power cell's impact crater. Cabrillo cursed. A team could fast rope down from the Hilo, grab the cell, and be back aboard by the time he and his men had covered half that distance. Without being spurred, the men put on a burst of speed, cutting through the jungle as if born to it. Juan ran with single-minded determination, starting to burn into reserves of strength that had never let him down before. He knew that even after everything they'd been through to get to this point, he was capable of a 6-minute mile. Mike Trono managed to keep pace, but Mark and Jerry were beginning to lag. The chopper inexplicably veered out of its hover and beat south, toward the logging camp. Cabrillo took this as a good omen and slowed, the turbines and rotor beat no longer masking the sound of his running. His chest heaved, but he forced his breathing under control by taking huge lungfuls of air to resaturate his tissues with oxygen. He could almost feel the lactic acid dissolving from his muscles. He and Mike dropped flat and began to crawl on their stomachs, making their final approach with serpentine stealth. The power cell had crashed into the earth at a shallow angle, tearing through the jungle and leaving in its wake a charred cone of foliage. The crater itself was a blackened ring of churned soil. 5 Argentine soldiers had roped down to the site. 2 of them were digging into the crater with shovels probably pilfered from the loggers, while the others had set up a strong perimeter. All 5 wore distinctive maroon berets. Juan knew from studying the 9th Brigade in order to impersonate them that they operated in squads of 6. There was another man out here with them, someone he couldn't see. He quickly triple-clicked his combat radio's mic. It was a command for everyone to hold in place and find cover. He and Mike could take out the 3 sentries before they could radio a warning and then take out the shovelers, who had both stripped to the waists and piled their gear a few yards off. But the 6th man, the invisible man, he was a wild card that would have to be dealt with first. Cabrillo unslung his MP5 machine pistol from around his neck. It would be nothing but a hindrance while he was stalking. The pistol, too, would remain in its holster. Even had he brought a silencer, the sound of a muffled shot would startle the local wildlife into panicked flight and alert the Argentines. He had known some men who preferred the intimacy of killing with a knife. He'd never liked or trusted any of them because of it, but he was familiar with the techniques and had employed them more than once. Killing with a knife was filthy work, and those that took to it, in his experience, did it more for the life they took than for furthering the goals of their mission. It was difficult to survey the scene. His view was obstructed, starting inches from his face, so it was difficult to place himself in the 6th man's mind and guess where he had positioned himself to secretly watch over his comrades digging to get the chunk of satellite. At the 10 o'clock position from where Juan lay, the undergrowth was thinner because several trees towered over it and blocked sunlight from nourishing the ground cover. This would give a gunman a better field of vision. Cabrillo decided that was where his man was waiting. He was just about to start out. He knew he would circle around, come at the 9th Brigader from the back, then he and Mike would take out the rest. Juan drew his knife, made a fractional move to his left, and froze. Voices. 12 or more, shouting and laughing as they charged through the jungle like a pack of wild boars.
It was a mix of soldiers and loggers, the men who had slogged up the mountain. The satellite's location had been radioed to them, and they had rushed to the scene. Cabrillo stayed still. Any action now would be suicide. Wary of the still-missing 6th squadmate, he resisted the urge to use the radio to call up Murph and Pulaski. Better they all remain as motionless as possible and wait to see what opportunity would present itself. For the hour it took the men to wrest the 70-pound power cell from the earth, Juan watched silently while next to him Mike slept. Somewhere in the jungle behind them, he knew either Mark or Jerry was also catching some much-needed sleep. They were close enough to the impact crater for Juan to overhear a lieutenant's call down to the command post.
"We have it, Jefe." "I'm not sure. It's about half a meter long, rectangular, and weighs maybe 30 kilos."
"What?"
"I don't know. Some sort of scientific apparatus, if I had to guess. I have no idea what its function—"
"No, sir. It will be easier if we carry it back to where they are loading logs from the men working the hillside. We saw that they have a couple of pickup trucks. We'll use those to get back down to the camp. The pilot should have found the electrical short in the chopper by the time we get there, and we can get back to base in time for cocktails at the O Club."
Cabrillo had heard enough. He knew their plan, and that was the edge he needed. He tapped Mike on the shoulder. The former rescue jumper came awake instantly, but silently. His combat awareness was acute even in sleep. Together they backed away from near the impact crater, making sure not to disturb vegetation overhead and marking their position. They met up with Jerry and Murph a quarter mile back.
"They've got the satellite," Murph said. "I can tell it's on the move."
Juan nodded, sipping from his canteen. He hadn't dared take a drink since first coming across the Argentine Special Forces.
"They're hiking it back to the trailhead, and then they'll drive it down to camp and fly out on the helos."
"And we're—"
Mark arched one goth-plucked eyebrow.
"Going to stop them."
Coming down the mountain in two parallel groups, the soldiers and the corporation team were converging on a leveled-off section of hillside, at least 2 acres across, that the loggers had cleared to set up some equipment. There was an excavator with a grapple for loading logs onto the semis and a machine called a cable yarder. The tracked yarder had a tall mast supporting wires that ran 2 miles down the hillside to a mobile spar that was anchored by guy lines at the base camp. From this long loop of cable dangled choker lines that the axemen could slip around the dressed trunks of felled trees. The logs were then hauled upslope to where they were placed on the tractor trailers, and the choker sent down again for the next load. The men who worked at this upper site had arrived from the base in the pickup trucks Raul Jimenez planned on procuring. Juan was confident his 4-man team could beat the larger Argentine group until they came across a cleft in the earth, the result of an earthquake that had split the land in two and caused part of the mountain to subside. Because of the jungle, it was impossible to know how far the fissure ran, so they had no choice but to treat it as an obstacle to be surmounted, not circumvented. In the geologic timescale, the Temblor had struck just a short while ago. 12,000 years, in fact. Enough time had elapsed that the sides of the fissure had eroded to a manageable slope, but they had to descend 50 feet and scramble up the other side using fingers and knees, brute strength, and muttered curses. They were all winded by the time they reached the top, and by Juan's watch they had lost 15 precious minutes. They ran on, hoping for the best, but fearing the worst. Juan had known since accepting the assignment from Langston Overholt that he hadn't had the time to put together an appropriate plan, and that was now coming to haunt him. They were facing 2 squads of Argentina's best-trained troops with nothing more than 4 machine pistols and the element of surprise. The odds of getting the power cell without engaging the soldiers were 0, and getting the cell and escaping back to Paraguay, he put it no better than 20-80.